Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to another installment of the video series called Studio 471. I'm speaking today with Jackie Burns-Coven, who's the head of cyber threat intelligence at Chainalysis. Thank you very much for joining me, Jackie.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy.
So we're going to probably have a chat that's mostly about ransomware, because that seems to be where most of the roads of cybercrime these days lead. And we've had some kind of disturbing statistics this year as far as like the amount of ransoms paid, and it looks like that we're probably on track for possibly a record-breaking year, or at least one that maybe matches, I think, 2021, which might have been the peak. What are you seeing as far as trends compared to last year and the year before?
That's exactly right, Jeremy. We published a mid-year crime report, which announced that, you know, 2022's decline in ransomware payments is not a trend. 2023 is still on pace to be one of, if not the worst years in terms of ransomware payments. So about last week, we recalculated our figures, and we're at about $480 million in ransom payments. Probably since we recalculated it, we've surpassed $500 million. So that in total, year to date, we're 50% more in ransomware payments than we were last year. So blowing last year out of the water, without a doubt, and certainly resembles our record year of 2021, unfortunately.
And so as far as victims, I guess we'll get into the rise in payments first. So I've seen things that says like some victims are paying less, but they're paying larger amounts because the ransomware groups are asking for higher ransoms. I think we kind of saw that with Clop. What are some of the, I guess, things that you're noticing in that area? Are more people paying, or is it hard to tell, or is it just people are paying more that decide to go that route to solve their issue?
Yeah, we're really seeing this interesting dichotomy in the data right now. And I think there's a confluence of factors that are contributing to larger payouts, as well as a lot of smaller payouts. So on the one hand, as you point out, we have this big resurgence of big game hunting. We're seeing increased usage of 0 days in ransomware attacks like we've never seen before. So we're seeing more sophisticated patient actors that are leveraging supply chain attacks in 0 days, able to target big game and extort larger demands. And on the other hand, we're seeing some less equipped or less sophisticated actors that are going for softer targets. And we think that's in large part due to, over the past few years, in the, you know, the epidemic of ransomware attacks that we've had over the last few years, has been a wake-up call for the entities, public sector as well as private sector, to shore up their defenses, to have a plan if they are attacked, to have backups, to have MFA, to have endpoint detection. And so that's made it a lot harder for ransomware actors. So we have the softer targets, schools and hospitals that are on like the longer tail of ransomware demands. And then we have perhaps out of desperation, and we're seeing some actors that are going to 0 days to attack victims, and in a single attack able to get hundreds, if not thousands, of victims. And then from there, it's just a numbers game. You know, if certain victims don't pay because they have backups, or their sanctions policy or risk tolerance or insurance policy, for whatever reason, negates the need to pay, there are certainly others in that hundreds or batch of thousands of victims that will. And so it's a sufficient payday either way. So it's a really interesting dichotomy that we're seeing on both ends.
And are you referring to Clop then, as far as the 0 day, because that was just an absolute standout, shocking attack of this year?
Certainly. And, they'd had some success earlier this year with Go Anywhere. And I think that, these different groups, they watch and learn from each other. And, you know, we quickly see adoption of different TTPs throughout these different groups. And so it certainly does set a startling trend to watch out for. And, you know, what that really, highlights to the industry is to know who your third parties are, know what's in your tech stack, because the huge problem with the move it or move IT, however you say it, attack, is that the victims didn't find out till much later that they had exposure to it. And so being able to have that accounting of your tech stack is incredibly important now.
Yeah, I think some victims had actually found out that they were victims because Klopp had published their data on the site. So there wasn't, and because of just, there were so many organizations hit at the same time, all the IR firms are completely overwhelmed with people calling like, am I caught up in this? Or, and if we use MoveIt, who do we exchange files with? And well, what's in MoveIt? Why did we leave files in MoveIt after we transferred them to a party? Like, a lot of interesting questions abounded by it. But I guess just the intensity of that attack was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, definitely a wake-up call and a highly attractive target.
Chainalysis published a really interesting graph in your mid-year report, and it was the distribution of ransom payments. And one of the things that you mentioned it was the increase in the very small ransom payments too, which I thought was quite interesting because it almost harked back to like 2014, 15, 16, before we had this big transition to big game ransomware. So do you think, is that an indication of just sort of, I don't know, I guess your petty internet street criminals dipping their toe into the ransomware gang and a game?
You know, it's interesting. When we actually tie these ransomware wallets to specific personal wallets, and we can actually see the types, like account for the number of individuals who are engaged in ransomware. And it's actually a smaller number than one might think. It's relatively static. We don't see a growing number of individuals engaging in it. I think it's just the change of the threat surface, really, the attack surface. There's because of these enhanced defenses and changes in policies in terms of whether or not they're allowed or able or even need to pay, I think has pushed demands in that way. That said, you know, these threat actors are getting better. They are looking for more lucrative payouts. And, you know, it's interesting. We saw, you know, a zero-day exploit with the Deadbolt ransomware attack, which had small amount, small demands, again, hearkening back to those WannaCry days. And so when you rack up thousands of victims like the Deadbolt ransomware case did, you know, that's pretty solid payday. But that overhead is, when you extort hundreds to thousands of victims, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of decryptors. That's a lot of negotiations at play. So I think that's driving the ecosystem to this trend we're seeing with a greater regularity, which is extortion only. No encryption at all, which is like the hallmark of ransomware. And not only does that ease the process of negotiating with the victim and the victim representative, but it also circumvents any possibility of a decryptor being out there. And we saw over the last few years, several even major ransomware strains getting burned because of the existence of a secret decryptor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's quite interesting, too. It's like, well, I mean, I also think it poses complications for them in the sense that some companies are going to say, well, if you want to read our, you know, our boring outlook, you know, fine, go ahead. We're not going to pay you for it. You know, at least it increases the potential resistance of victims because there's no operational impact. You know, you don't have systems that are actually down. You just have data that's lost, which you know, you're going to have to report it to regulators either way. And, you know, you get into the questions of, well, can you trust these people to delete it as well? So, I mean, do you think that potentially has advantages, I guess, for defenders of like, well, okay, they're just stealing data rather than they're going to shut down our entire factory for, you know, and we're going to have to go into an extensive BCDR, you know, process afterwards.
Yeah, I'm not sure that victims are treating extortion or exfiltration only and encryption any differently. I think the risks are the same. I think, for public companies now, there's the SEC regulation that will come into effect this December, which gives victims of a material cyber event 4 days to report it. So I think there's really no size company that or entity that is immune to this. And unfortunately, we're even seeing ransomware being used as a guise, to as a cover for espionage. So in some cases, we're seeing extortion with no chance of payment, no way to pay, extortion demands that exceed what is even covered by insurance. And so these are pretty brazen, intelligence-driven operations versus financially driven operations in some cases. And so there's definitely the possibility that certain attacks are accomplishing both. They're getting a payout, but also gaining valuable intelligence. So we've had, with the recent designation of additional TrickBot members, US government and UK government coming out quite pointedly and pointing out ties to Russian intelligence services. So, and it's not a it's not isolated alone to Russia. We've seen Iranian and North Korean actors doing exactly the same thing.
And I think back also to the Outlook vulnerabilities I think it was early 2021, where we saw all those Outlook web-facing instances were compromised, and it looked like that was a state-motivated sort of attack. But then there was a little bit of ransomware on the side too. So I guess for governments, that's probably quite it really raises the level of these sorts of cyber criminal actions, right? That like they're not just in the cybercrime sphere anymore. They're in both spheres, which really brings I guess a new level of really I guess reason for action.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Whispergate comes to mind as well, ransomware disguising a wiper in actuality. But what's even more fascinating to me is that that wiper is based strongly on the black or white crypt code, which actually did extort ransom payments. So it's a fascinating overlap. We have financially motivated criminals that are looking a lot like APTs, and APT is looking a lot like e-criminals. And its attribution is incredibly important in the state of geopolitical environment right now.
You brought up money laundering, and let's talk about that. There was a Wired story a few months ago that I think summarized some of the data that Chainalysis had put out in a really succinct way, and it was like 70% of cyber criminal related funds are just going through five cryptocurrency exchange. Like there seems to be these, or I guess I'll ask the question to you: are there these choke points then there that are becoming quite evident as some of these sort of, I guess, kind of fringe, small money laundering operations just kind of like either get busted or go out of business? Is there a real funneling of these funds into choke points that can be focused on?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen that with like great regularity and unpredictability that global governments are going after these services that are providing laundering services for ransomware as well as other cyber enabled crime. And what that's done, it's really created a lot of tumults in the laundering ecosystem if you're a criminal. So mixers, Chipmixer, Blender.io, Tornado Cash, and a handful of Russian-based services, Bitzlato, Garantex, Suex, in nearly every one of those either designations or takedowns or special measures, ransomware was mentioned as one of the primary reasons for the action. And it's funneled that the off-ramps into even more concentrated services for laundering ransomware proceeds as well as the proceeds of other types of crime. And it's created a lot of distrust because and anxiety within the threat actor ecosystem because, you have new mixers popping up, but they have no credibility. You don't understand the algorithm. There's really no transparency there. And you don't know if, perhaps they'll be next. We really are seeing funds entrusted into a handful of services. What we called out in our crime report as well was the uptick of funds going to underground services. So no ClearNet presence at all these dark web services that only advertise in underground forums with the intent of laundering dirty money. For lack of just advertising blatantly to that effect.
And are those services going to be able to accommodate? I guess for some of these groups, it's just enormous amounts of money, like almost incomprehensible amounts of money to try to convert to fiat. I mean, does that pose as just sort of a natural barrier to some of these e-crime groups meaningfully cashing out?
The beauty of the blockchain is that whether it's a small amount or a large amount, it will leave a trail that can be traced and tracked. And whether it's a ClearNet service or a service that leverages the underground economy, we can still shine a spotlight on that service. And I think global governments have shown that they're able to identify them and they're able to take action that will effectively dismantle these illicit services.
And I guess the beauty of monitoring stuff in the blockchain too is that you can set alerts so funds can sit in there for years and years and years, and you can just follow them around until there's some mistake.
Right. And I think there's been many actions taken within the last year that are the result of years-long investigations because of that immutable blockchain that is there and providing leads to attribution as well as even seizure of assets.
I want to go back to that chart about the distribution of ransomware payments, because there was another really interesting part in that as well. And it's the part that's kind of marked in blue. And it's like these are big ransomware payments. They're ones that go above 100,000 upwards to 10 million. And that really widened this year, or for the first half of 2023. So I guess we interpret from that if ransomware criminals are having problems finding targets that will pay, hitting more, because the activity seems to be pretty robust out there, but they're just hoping to get that one that goes, oh, okay, we're really in a bind, we'll pay this seven figure, eight figure ransom to try to ostensibly solve our problem.
Yeah, I don't bat an eye anymore at seven figures. Eight figures has become more commonplace. And I think we're seeing average payments increase as well. I think, it's just a part of the sophistication. And when you have an exploit that impacts large entities, large customers, yeah, I think that's the state we're in right now. I think we attribute a lot of this resurgence in payments to the tide of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. That last year's stark decline, we attribute in large part due to actors on both sides of the conflict being resettled or redirecting their efforts towards the military or finding new homes, and that's taken a lot out of commission last year. Now that year of service is over, or they've resettled in other locations, we think that has led in part to the resurgence of the ransomware that we're seeing in 2023.
That's interesting. So it looks like that some of these threat actors have sort of reconstituted after taking care of whatever personal impacts came as a result of the conflict.
That's correct. Yes, we've seen actors from both sides of the conflict may have had to enroll in military service or relocate, and are now back to business. But that said, business might have changed slightly. Like we saw in our crime report last year, you might recall that Cuba ransomware was on a pretty steady streak in terms of ransomware proceeds. And then about midway through last year, we saw those proceeds drop off entirely. And we weren't really sure what to make of it at the time. But actually, Google Mandiant put out a report that offered other indicators that the Cuba ransomware team had diverted their financially motivated ransomware efforts towards espionage instead. So it's just one example of how one group had pivoted to e-crime to espionage.
I'd like to talk a little bit about sanctions, and you brought this up earlier because there's been just a whole lot of things going on in this area. Recently, there was a second round of sanctions against the Conti TrickBot threat actors. There's also been sanctions levied against cryptocurrency exchanges and mixers. What has been the effect of sanctions on threat actors, and what have been the effects on organizations that have to navigate sanctions as part of a security incident?
It strikes me as incredibly interesting the diverse array of entities that have been designated as in part of this combating ransomware effort that we're seeing. We've seen mixers, we've seen darknet markets like Hydra, exchanges, and even individuals themselves. A year or two ago, we saw two Revil individuals added to the OFAC SDN list. We've seen Iranian actors who engaged in ransomware added, and now an increasing array of members of TrickBot. And it certainly shines a spotlight on these actors, definitely makes travel a whole lot harder, and I think kind of ingratiates them into their native countries. It'd be really hard for them to travel. And I think it also on-chain highlights the payment disparity between these members. We can see on-chain when we look at these individuals that were designated, we can see their connections, we can see the basically chain of command in terms of the flow of money and the amounts. And it's been really interesting to identify their roles, as well as, even some actors having side gigs because they're not making enough money with the gangs that they're in. So, I think that these designations are really an important tool. You got to love to see the law enforcement action and designations coming in. That 1-2 punch is really powerful. And I think, but these sort of actors adapt, right? They're finding new financial off ramps. And I think it also highlights the importance of targeting the individuals rather than ransomware strains. And I think that's, without a doubt, people who are following this space are well aware of the rebranding these ransomware strains have undergone over the years, whether the large strain finds itself in hot water or it's been identified that a strain is based in Iran. We're seeing this rapid rebranding. And so being able to focus on the individuals rather than the ransomware family or strain itself is really critical in being able to combat this.
And is that because, they're not going to change identities while ransomware chains or strains are just kind of chasing an ever-changing sort of, I think ransomware strains have an average life of, maybe 3 or 4 months looking across the spectrum, whereas somebody's identity that's their identity forever. Is that the thinking behind targeting individuals rather than just kind of a temporary strain?
Right. And Intel 471 does a tremendous job at understanding the underground economy and the actors in it, in the centers of gravity, whether those are individuals, whether those are tools and services. That marketplace is incredibly important to understand. And I really can't speak more highly of Intel 47's work in this space.
Well, thank you very much. And we're very appreciative of the great research that Chainalysis does and the tools that it produces. I mean, as far as what we've seen this year, one of the most significant things is that we've seen an absolute explosion in initial access brokering. And so these are threat actors that specialize in gaining access and stealing login credentials and then selling that access to other people in the cyber criminal ecosystem. And it's absolutely exploded this year. In the first half, we saw more than 2,000 claims from access vendors that were offering to sell access or compromise credentials. And so that was an increase of 23%. From the first half of last year. And if you look at access brokering, why it's such a popular product is because that's the sort of first step in ransomware or data breach or intruding into an organization is that you've got to get inside. And so this is a shortcut way to get in. But I know you've got to run, Jackie, but thank you so much for chatting with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. This was a lot of fun.